all of college and work as a medical social worker and call myself a budding ethicist.
And I'm Dan Spencer. I teach religion and ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been a member of the Central Iowa Health Systems Bioethics Committee. So that's given me some exposure to these issues.
What we're trying to do this week is really enable primarily lay people, although many healthcare professionals don't do this as well as we need to also, but be able to talk about difficult bioethical situations in language that we can all understand and we can all work with, so that when we need to make a decision in a situation that has inherent dilemma or dilemmas, we can make it the best way possible. So our goal is for folks to be able to use some of the commonly used language so that we can do our best when we're faced with these difficult situations. Let me ask, who's new here today, wasn't here yesterday? Oh, a number, okay, good. How many folks, again, in the audience are healthcare providers of some sort, right? Today, any neurologists? Neurosurgeons, transplant surgeons, okay. Any, in all seriousness, although that's serious too, any organ donors or recipients in the audience? Okay, great, wonderful. Don't feel pressured to talk, but we're happy to have folks who have experience with these situations. We also have at least one person I'm aware of who is here at the Village knowing that there is a dramatic situation unfolding in his home community. And I've asked him to talk about that when the time comes, if he's feeling comfortable to do that. So we know that this is timely information for many of us. Dan's going to review a couple of the key terms here, keeping in mind that we're going to leave these up, these posters up through the week for people to review if you want to. We're going to do a much briefer review today and have more time with our case.
If you recall, part of those of you who were here yesterday, we spent a fair amount of time with this. What we're trying to do is both give you some vocabulary. If you get pulled into some of these discussions, you'll hear terms that can be helpful to understand how they're used. It helps build a kind of a common language to talk about. And then to give a case or a model for ways to work carefully through an issue here. We went through all these terms yesterday. I wanted to simply highlight a few of them here. We call it, when we talk about an ethical issue is any course of action that affects, in this case, human well-being. So any interactions we have ethical dimensions because they have to do with the ways we treat each other, with respect, without respect, ways that are right or wrong. We're going to contrast that with an ethical dilemma. An ethical dilemma is when our ethical values, our principles, our actions come into conflict in a particular situation. So ethical issue is a much broader category than an ethical dilemma. The vast majority of us go through life every day facing lots of ethical issues and not thinking consciously about them because we've already learned already it's not appropriate to steal, it's not appropriate to hit your brother or sister, these kinds of things, so we don't think consciously. But we do occasionally come into conflicts that really test our ability to know what to do. And so we'll be focusing on these ethical dilemmas that we've been talking about here. And they will have to do with the, with what we value, what we hold as a deeply held belief or commitment, what we understand as both rights and duties in response to this. And then the other thing we'll be talking about as well are the ethical principles here. Again, keeping in mind that a fundamental assumption in this is that human beings have intrinsic value. We can't treat another human being simply as a means to some other end. We have to take into consideration the value they have for their own sake. But the instrumental value that each of us have in our relationships can be an important consideration. Mary, do you want to?
Yep. Sorry for the lighting. It's not necessarily great. Yesterday, people came up and looked at this more carefully. Feel free to do that when you're in your groups. But I want to highlight for folks who are new today the four primary principles that are used commonly in healthcare situations in our country. We neglected to preface this yesterday by saying this is really the principles approach in the Western tradition of ethics, that there are many cultures, many of whose members live in our communities, who don't necessarily hold to these principles the way we're presenting them. My personal belief is that we need to understand these first, because it's the tradition out of which most of us come as religious or philosophical groundings, but we must always be aware of differences with other cultures. Those are non-maleficence, generally speaking, do no harm. Do not harm, right from the Hippocratic Oath. Beneficence, the flip side in some ways of, in addition to doing no harm, trying to promote whole well-being, and we purposely use the term whole because we think well-being is more than physical well-being. That is emotional, psychological, spiritual well-being is what we hope people will consider when they consider beneficence. Beneficence, a little bit of confusion came up yesterday. Beneficence refers to whole well-being of the patient with whom we are working. Not the whole family, not the other people who might be involved, but the patient in this principles approach. Autonomy, that is the right to choose for oneself, self-determination, phrases that you probably know quite well. Out of that come the legal ideas about informed consent, decision-making or decisional capacity, people who can decide for themselves are able to do so, and the idea of surrogacy, which will come up a bit today in the case too. Last but certainly not least, and these are in no particular order, the principle of justice, which in its simplest form is fairness, talks also about reciprocity and equity in relationships. So those are the ones we highlight, but feel free all through the week to bring up other principles because many of them are involved in most of our cases, of course, to make them more complex.
And just a reminder, as Mary mentioned yesterday, if the principles function in bioethics in particular as action guides, that is, they are the kind of the distilled wisdom of a culture or a religious tradition that serve as action guides for us. Most of these principles function, I don't know if we talked about this term yesterday, this is when you finally get enough education, you feel like you can throw these terms around, but this is, I think, a helpful one. We say that these principles are prima facie principles. Prima facie simply means on the face of it. That is, these principles are binding in most situations, but there'll be times when they come into conflict with each other, and then you have to violate one principle in order to uphold another one. We gave the example yesterday about there may be situations where you have to violate confidentiality in order to prevent harm from someone else. So it's not that the principle of confidentiality is not valid, but it's not an absolute principle. It's a prima facie principle. It's valid, it's binding, unless it's in conflict with something that's a greater good or greater principle at that time. Another thing I want to mention, a couple of things, and then I'm going to go through our review our steps here. Jim Nelson, who's an ethicist that both Mary and I know and admire, says a couple of things that I think are very helpful. He said, good ethics is like turning on a light in a dark room. It helps see things more clearly. You can walk into that room and bump around lots of things and find your way around, but you turn on the light and it helps clarify things. And so good ethics, that's why we always start with gathering relevant facts and information. We need to understand the situation clearly before we proceed. And the other thing is that he reminds us is that ethics always involves both our cognitive thinking abilities, but also our values, the affective elements. And he has a phrase that I find helpful. He says we want to be neither a headless heart nor a heartless head when we're doing ethics. It involves both our hearts and our heads as we do that. So keep in mind, both values and rational thinking are important. In the model that we've been using and are going to continue to work through the week here, it draws on both our principles and also potential consequences. So the first three steps, I mentioned before, the first step is simply to gather the relevant facts and information, to know as much as you can about a particular case, knowing that you're almost always going to want to know more than the information that you have available, but you've got to operate with what you have available. And we'll be doing this step together throughout the week of gathering the relevant facts and information with you as a group before we turn you loose on the rest of this. Then the second step is a couple different things. It's to identify the ethical issues. Why is this an ethical issue to begin with? And part of what we're going to suggest to do is to think about which of these principles, these action guides, are relevant and why. So as part of your identifying the ethical issue, see, is this an issue where autonomy is at stake? Is this an issue where the fidelity of the trust relationship is at stake? But which principles are at stake and why? And then once you clarify that, where is it truly a dilemma? If it's an ethical dilemma, some of these principles will be conflicting with each other. That means that you can't act in a way to uphold all of them. So one will have to be overridden. And that's when you have a conflict, whether values, principles, or actions come in conflict. So this second step is a very important step, and we'll be spending a lot of time emphasizing that this week here. Once you've done that, it becomes important to generate alternatives and look at their likely consequences. Now, I say likely consequences because my students have a wonderful time generating amazingly far-fetched alternatives with even more far-fetched consequences. It's not important, but you want to also assess them whether they're likely or not. And we talk about them, you assess these alternatives and consequences both in terms of whether they're good or bad, but also short-term and long-term. Something that may seem very appealing in the short-term may have negative long-term consequences, such as if it establishes a precedent that can't be upheld across society. So to think about that, those issues as well. All of this, we simply say, is analyzing the situation itself before you get into moral deliberation, before we begin to think ethically. And that happens in the second half, the next three or four steps here. The fourth step is once you've got these alternatives and consequences, and in some cases we'll have just one or two, other cases may have almost unlimited. But once take a look at these alternatives and consequences and assess them in light of the relevant values and principles. For example, physician-assisted suicide, some of you came up with and said, well, look, we haven't explored all the consequences. We should explore hospice. We should explore better pain medication. There are other things we should explore before we're ready to decide. And so that's when you begin to assess some of the alternatives. Why would those be either positive or negative alternatives in this step here? We talked that it's important at some point to check and see, is motive relevant? The very same action can be either ethical or unethical depending on the motive that's involved in there. So to look at that there. And then what's oftentimes difficult is to actually choose, and once you've gone through this, is choose a step and then be able to justify it. Say why this is the strongest or the best case. And what I oftentimes do with my students, we're going to ask you to do that today, is to do that by countering opposing claims. Show why yours is the best one by answering an opposing claim that would say, no, I think we should do it this way. So that final step there. And then the seventh step that we don't have on here, but it's always part of this, is ongoing evaluation. We revisit our issues, we revisit our decisions in order, as we gain better insight, to keep thinking about that as well. Mary, did I leave anything out on that?
I don't think so. I learn something new every time I teach with Dan. It's really fun. But it's nice that the tension doesn't go up when he says you need to be arguing and evaluating the opposing claims, because that's when students go, ooh, you mean I have to think like someone who disagrees from me might think, and then I have to justify why I think what I think? That's what's difficult about ethics, I think. What do you think? No.
I think you're wrong.
It's also nice to learn from James B. Nelson from Dan Spencer while we're up here. Okay, today we're doing a case that's new for us. We've taught before at Holden, and we try to change cases and update cases. It keeps us a little fresher, and as we saw yesterday, it's helpful to have people in the room who know more about certain pieces of cases than we do, because it helps us refine our case as well. So the first thing I try to always say, particularly in practice on ethics committees, is that doing ethical decision making is not a solo endeavor. We must not try to do it alone. As a philosopher, as a physician, as a hospital administrator, as a mental health person, this is a team concept, ethical decision making. So consult, consult, consult. If for no other reason, I say to my licensed social work grads, your license could be in jeopardy if you say, yeah, I did this, and no, I didn't ask anybody about it. Nope, didn't consult at all. Not a good idea. So the team approach is really useful.
Should we perhaps see if anybody has questions so far?
Oh, yeah, let's do that before I get
into it. We've gone very quickly over this stuff today, which we spent more time with yesterday, but are there questions or clarifications about either these terms, the principles we're using, or the approach, the model?
I didn't hear you use the scientific term trade-off that I think is involved here in this considering which way to go.
Say more about what you mean by the scientific term trade-off.
That was in quotes.
We have to, of course, take into consideration the good and the bad and make a trade-off and realize that we may not be happy with the final solution, but that's the one we have to take.
Yeah, my simple response to that is that when we're done, all is said and done, decision made, we still have a feeling in our gut. And that identifies that it really was a dilemma. And that really there is no perfect solution for this for people who are carefully thinking it through. Now, there are people who are absolutist, one way or the other, or many ways. In philosophical and religious ethical traditions, there are some people who say there's just no question in this case, this is what you do, and they feel perfectly fine. Most of us find it more gray than that when we go really into unpacking a case. So you're right, it is about trade-offs of values, it's about trade-offs sometimes of principles. This one, in this case, trumps it. There have been authors who rate the principles. We have a couple social work authors, ethicists, who have 7 principles, and they rate them. This one is the most important, and this one is the least. And in a case where they conflict, you always pick this one. Well, that's highly controversial.
For example, I come out of the Roman Catholic tradition, and in the Roman Catholic tradition, sanctity of life is really the fundamental. You just simply, everything else is subordinated to sanctity of life, and that becomes the guidance. So there are different ways of thinking about that. But in terms of what Mary was saying, we use the example of times when you had to break confidentiality. And you may feel it was very much justified, but I know in the situation I've had that even though I thought I knew I was doing the right thing, it still was hard to break the confidentiality that someone else was assuming they had in our relationship. And so you can still feel you're acting the most morally correct way, but it's a true dilemma if you feel like you wish you'd been able to avoid it.
Okay, we are not experts in organ donation. And organ transplantation, but we've tried to do some of background gathering of data, and I'm going to give you some general background stuff about organ donation in our country right now. It is changing every day, and our situation tomorrow, our case, also has to do with a different aspect of organ donation. But let me say a couple things. Organs can only be procured, and we use that term and not harvested anymore. Procured.
Thank you, Robin Kirk.
From a good friend of mine. Only after the person is declared brain dead. A person is dead when they get organs taken from them. That's important for families in particular to hear frequently. The organs that are procured remain viable because of mechanical respiration and circulation. That keeps them viable. They don't stay viable very long. Hours to maybe a few days, depending on the situation, but it's not long for them to need to be procured. There is high controversy about how death is decided in our country. For centuries, death was declared when somebody wasn't breathing anymore and their heart wasn't beating. And for a long time, people would put a little mirror up and see if there was any fog on the mirror. If it wasn't there, dead. Put the ear to the chest, if it wasn't beating, dead. What has changed that? EEGs for brain waves, EKGs for hearts. The stethoscope was the first thing that changed. So we could put a little machine on here and hear if something was going on in there. It was better than the human ear. So technology has changed that a great deal. And there's conflict about this worldwide. There are some countries who disagree with what we've decided in this country is a determination of death. So for a long time, it was death that had to do with cardiac and respiratory function. Now we talk about brain death. And let me give you a sort of lay definition of brain death. This comes from the guidelines that the organ procurement organizations locally give to hospitals. Brain death is defined as the irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brain stem back here. All functions of the entire brain ceasing is brain death. That needs to occur before organs can be procured. Okay? We'll probably come back to that with docs in the audience. Or others. There is a shortage of all organs in our country. People die every day. I didn't get exact data of how many people waiting for which organs die every day, but deaths are happening all the time as people wait for organ transplant possibilities. As safety of transplants has increased, the meds are getting better, the likelihood of survival longer is increasing, availability has gone down. We have more people needing organs, and so there are fewer organs for those more people in general. There's a very low percentage of organs which are viable, that is, potentially procurable, that are procured than could be. And we'll come back to that. Tomorrow's case will have a lot to do with technology, so come back tomorrow if you're interested. There are a couple of types of organ donors, living and cadaver. don't know why they just don't say liver and dead, but people donate liver, I mean kidneys often. We have two, we can live with one, so living donors can donate kidneys. And then other organs are procured after brain death. Those are called cadaver organs. So those are really the two. I laughed because Spence and I looked back at our other notes and listened to our tapes, and I quoted a study, a Gallup poll from I don't know what year, couldn't tell you where I got it. The Gallup poll said 85% of people they surveyed would donate their relatives' organs, 85%. Like yesterday, sure, the doc can help with suicide. I'm not gonna, the doctor can. And 45% would donate their own. Interesting. I don't know if that's, you know, scientifically proven, but I would believe that. I would believe something like that. 1968, the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, a federal act, is the legislation that encouraged routine inquiry. When there has been a brain death and organs would be viable for procurement for transplantation, people are generally asked now because of that act. It depends on your area, how often and who does it and how well they're trained and how well they do it, but generally routine inquiry happens. Somewhere between 40 and 50,000 organs are transplanted a year in the United States. Anybody else know data you think generally we should mention before we get to the case? Yeah.
How many did
you
say?
Ooh, yeah.
How many?
40 to 50,000 a year. Cost of a transplanted pancreas for the time of the need being determined to a year after in Minnesota, $80,000 to $90,000. But that's just for a year.
You're 80, talking about just the procedure?
That's everything together for a pancreas. That's the one I asked about because we were going to use a pancreas case.
Yeah. Also resources that are involved, like a liver transplant will drain a blood bank because of all the blood, leaving no blood left for trauma victims. Or
so I think the $80,000 to $90,000 was for the person, the cost for the person. It doesn't take into account. That's right, the utility, the cost for others who don't get that blood that was then used. Right.
So who actually pays for that then? Say I want to donate something, who would pay for that?
Yeah, if you were to donate, there's no cost to the donor family. Now remember, the donor's dead, so we don't charge the donor. But to the donor family, no cost. That is picked up by insurance, private pay. You've probably all donated money to a cause. So-and-so needs an organ. Let's donate money. It may be medical assistance, which is welfare, depending on the organ. And it has to be a procedure that is no longer considered experimental in the medical world. It has to be approved as successful, and those variations in success, depending on the organ, are quite complicated. But some insurances won't pay for some transplants. It depends. We just had a big issue for women with breast cancer in Minnesota about having bone marrow transplant, and one woman fought it and fought it and fought it, and her HMO, finally she sued them and they paid. But that's considered sort of quasi-experimental still, bone marrow transplants for breast cancer.
Mary, one more question.
Yeah, one more question, you.
Why aren't Christians right up front in donating? Because after all, we believe in the soul, the body is secondary, or do Christians believe that the body is God's temple, not to be tampered with?
Well, I think you could find a Christian that would believe in both of those and somewhere in between. I think we'd have a difference of opinion right here, and that's part of what's incredibly difficult for people. That's a very good question. Okay, we should go to the case. Dan's going to read it today. I'll hand it out as yesterday, probably two per or three per, I'm afraid. To share.
Send some up to the balcony there too.
And try to stay a little quiet while he reads the case for the tape, and then we'll start on it together, all together.
Can someone send three or four up to the balcony so they can.
Here, can I stand up and give them a how about that?
I'll read the case and then we'll give you some instructions for how to proceed with your committee work on it. Okay. 36-year-old John is brought to a trauma center near death after an accident. Tests determine he has some brain function, but he can only breathe with the aid of a respirator. Another accident victim, Chris, is brought to the same center with a severely damaged liver. She is in need of an immediate transplant. Without this transplant, Chris will likely die, but with it, she would have a chance of recovery. Surgeons at this hospital are among those who have transplanted part of a liver from a living donor. It appears that this will not affect John's prognosis. John did sign a donor card found in his wallet, which states that he would agree to organ donation if he was declared brain dead. His parents have agreed to the procurement of a part of his liver. A test was quickly done, which established a positive tissue match between the victims. Is it morally justifiable to remove a part of the liver from John to save Chris?
Now, lest anybody say, oh, that's not going on. It's going on. Minnesota Mayo Clinic, this is going on.
We'll talk more about some actual cases on this as well, but what we'd like you to think about is this is a case that has a certain degree of urgency with it. All right, so we'd like to imagine yourself, you are part of a hospital ethics committee that has been asked for an emergency consult on this. You have a limited amount of time, say 20 to 30 minutes, to think through the case and give an answer about whether or not this is morally justifiable course of action.
So, let's do this together. What else? You're called in, you've got 20 to 30 minutes. What do you want to know for sure before you start discussing? And we made a decision after yesterday. We'll decide what we give you and what we don't. But there are some things we'll clarify here. What do you need?
Are there any other livers available?
No.
Yeah, no.
Do we know what effects this will have on the donor's possible recovery? Is it further damage his health, or is it neutral?
We used likely because it seems thus far in a fairly experimental effort that it doesn't seem to hurt the donor. Doesn't seem to fairly likely.
There's no certainty, but that's
no
the
certainty.
Prognosis
given his,
is.
Given his current condition.
There's risk.
There's risk, yeah. It's an invasive procedure. It's cutting into him and cutting out part of his liver.
Yeah.
Right.
A lot.
Right.
It would seem to me like we would have to assess whether John is likely to conscious enough to help make a decision.
Yeah, he's not likely in 20 to 30 minutes to become conscious enough.
In fact, the prognosis...
By minimum brain function here, this we will give you. He is not brain dead. He cannot be diagnosed in a persistent vegetative state for weeks to months. He has some activity on his EEG, for those of you who care about that, and some gag reflex.
But the prognosis is very unlikely that he's going to live.
Yeah. He will likely die, but we don't know.
Is there any precedent for anyone living with that?
Living with partial organ?
With his brain condition. You know, the damage that's been done, is there any precedent for recovery?
Yeah, there's precedent for recovery, let's say, and there's likelihood of PVS, and the most likely scenario is he dies.
I say with PVS again.
Persistent vegetative state, which why don't we get into when we debrief the case?
Yeah.
Back here, you had another one?
It's my understanding that people can live just fine with part of the liver.
Yes,
that's
my understanding.
That's what the docs involved are saying, that it will, this could be done without.
And I didn't get the detail about this, but my friend who runs the organ procurement organization in Minnesota and the Dakotas said it involves taking about a quarter of the liver.
It's a risky procedure.
There's certainly some risk.
Is there a family member who would be compatible that would be willing to donate to Chris?
No.
Not in this situation.
What are the chances of success? If you say if a person can live, what's the record?
If there's so few that have happened so far, it's so new, we don't really have any good data about that.
One more. Trauma he endured and what his status is in terms of the rest of his body.
From who?
The donor, would be donor.
What's he
was in a car wreck?
Yeah.
So what other kinds of injuries did he?
That's a good question. We're not going to say what other kinds of injuries. He's just about dead. He's dying.
Parents are next to Ken.
They are. He's single.
He's single.
Yeah.
Good question.
Okay, we should have you get into your groups. We would like you, and we had one person request this ahead of time. Please reiterate, Mary, to the groups, to work through the steps. Do not get in your groups and say, well, of course you should donate it. Well, of course you don't. This is not useful for learning about bioethics, okay? We want you to focus on the dilemma, the principles involved and the dilemma. And then we want you to get down here, because you got not much time. You got to decide, because Chris is going to die very shortly without a liver.
You've got steps 3 and 4, which are alternatives and consequences. You got basically 2. You do it or you don't.
That's right.
Okay.
And you,
you have about 15.
15.
Yeah.
15 minutes.
Yes or no, but why you would say that?
You spent the first 5 minutes already asking questions.
Yeah, right. You got all the daddy in here.
Okay, if we can get folks to reorient your attention this direction here. We actually spent a little bit of time at the beginning identifying the ethical issues, if there are, what are the relevant principles that are involved, and if there is a dilemma. And let's start first with what did you identify? Mary's going to write them down. What did you identify as any of these principles that may be relevant to this particular case? Do no harm, not maleficence, all right? And why? How do you see it as relevant?
Because there is no benefit to John in doing the surgery. You can only do harm to him.
So when you relate, in the care of the physician's relationship to the John, primary concern is above all is do no harm. And there is risk here. Okay, what else?
Beneficence.
Beneficence in which regard?
That a life would be saved.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't benefit John.
All right, this is a big issue here. Is this beneficence towards Chris or beneficence towards John?
Towards Chris.
Towards Chris. We're talking about duty to promote the whole well-being. But, well, again, the question then, does that then justify an action of taking something from someone else?
From an ethical perspective, we have to look at John.
Mm-hmm. John's got to be, we're talking about an invasive activity on John here.
You mean John over Chris?
Yes.
Yeah. Because, well, if we're dealing with John here,
we're dealing with John and Chris here.
We're dealing with John and Chris. All right, let's start back here and we'll come back. Okay, well, so that may be one way of interpreting beneficence on there, if he's given us enough advance directive, all right? Has he?
No, he hasn't.
That's going to be part of the issue here. Pete's saying you can't assume that.
Autonomy. He can choose. We don't know if he's going to, he still has a chance at life. He still has a chance of coming back out of his coma. So he...
Now, are we in the realm of surrogacy decision-making here?
Yes, we are.
What do you mean surrogacy?
Well, his parents making a decision for him.
He has no decision over that.
He has a donor card which presumes brain death. But he has given an idea, right? I would like to donate in that situation. His parents are legal surrogates for him. He is single. They are legal surrogates. They've said to do it.
But he's not totally brain dead, so we have to deal with
that. That's correct. Okay, you already spoke. Let's go. A couple people didn't speak yet.
And we're simply just getting the relevant principles out here. We'll get into the analysis minute. What other principles are involved?
Nine.
Utility. How's utility involved here?
Raise numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Maximize the social well-being.
All right. Do you want 2 deaths or 1?
1.
All right. It's pretty good chance that John's gone. It's sad. So do we let go of Chris as well?
No.
I'm John's
utilitarian.
Sister.
You're John's sister.
And
you're not
I
in the picture.
I disagree with my parents. Mine's brother would not.
And what principle are you invoking here?
Well, do no harm.
Do no harm. Any other principles that people see relevant here, Grace?
Fidelity. Because if, in fact, he signed this donor card, assuming he would be brain dead when his organs were harvested, you are undermining his trust.
Potentially violating that, the conditions of the relationship. Yeah, fidelity here. Back here?
Fidelity can go both ways, because if his parents know something about his wishes that is not conveyed on that card, then they have to remain faithful to what they have promised him. But it might not be on the card, so they would have to give consent.
But would that be the case if somebody had a living will that said specifically don't do something, and then the next day he came forward saying, no, that's not what I really want? The living will is still the primary.
But he doesn't. We don't know that he has a living will.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying that's a similar case. So you have to go to the original document unless he's counteracted that writing somehow. Okay.
Have we exhausted the principles?
Okay. I mentioned respect for persons, because it's just tempting to think of him as a non-person or as a potential.
His instrumental value.
Is his treating him simply instrumentally, yeah. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Respect. Thank you.
I think I'm going to see not only from the perspective of the caregivers, when they don't know for sure that he is granddad, and they give an indication, oh, this is only a matter of hours anyway, to the parents, and then they give their okay to this. You know, how honest can you be in a situation where you really don't know all of how the outcome is?
Yeah, there's certainly a certain degree of uncertainty, you know, that we just, and as Pete also mentioned, risk. And so you can try and give your best prognosis and try and get the best thing, but there are all going to be vested interests. When we talk about motive in here, you know, there are lots of different motives in here that are going to affect this. It doesn't mean they're unethical motives, but they are relevant motives.
Yeah, what about the surgeon who's getting excited about this new potential for liver transplant? If it's that surgeon who talks to the family, there is a law that the surgeon who procures an organ is not the doctor who talks to the family.
Mm-hmm. Precisely to protect against that.
So we assume they haven't been deceived, that they've been told what the change.
At least in this case, people are giving their best information. Yeah, there's no attempt to be deceptive here. Yeah.
Institutional or stage specific, because of the law in that specific stage or institution. If they're a teaching medical center, they're more open to experiment, not necessarily, but you know what I'm saying? If you're an institution, if you're in a small country hospital, it's not a question of what kind of diet, whereas if you're in the someone can open to this
Yeah.
And does that change the ethical analysis for you, or does that mean that there's different, the context will shape different results, but the ethical analysis is still?
I just think that's because then the question is brought up in the ethical.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Sue?
We have a piece that doesn't fit, and that's the issue of precedent. If we do it here, what do we do about the next case? Now, our group limited us to not being able to consider that because we're only talking about John. But somewhere there's that question.
Boom. And that is part of this. You're assessing short and long-term consequences somewhere in this model as well.
Is it also a utility question?
Well, and people bring up slippery slope concerns. You know, if you slip on this one, have you just moved further down the line here? Let's go here and then Pete.
I feel that the surgeons say they do this all the time. This is going to harm John. John's in a shocking, precarious situation as he is. And who can say, I was about to say, that major surgery is not going to do any harm to that patient.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's under non-maleficence for John.
And I guess this should come under gather all the facts and information, but the whole issue of waiting lists for organs, is there another person who could possibly use that?
Justice.
For utility and justice. And
justice. Is it just the quirkiness that Chris got brought in at this point, and maybe someone else could use John's organ who's been on that list for 2 years? I may die tomorrow if he doesn't get that organ, but Chris just happens to be the one who showed up right now.
And you can see what John's life is going to be by the time he donates the organ. Could he die? His organ still could be used.
All right, let's do a quick polling of the group here and see where people come. Did any small group reach consensus?
Yeah, we
did. Right? Let's just, what, those of you reach consensus, what'd you decide?
We did it just from John's perspective, and we decided that there was no dilemma since he specifically had pre-existing orders that only his organs be donated if he was brain dead. Since
okay.
he was not brain dead, that didn't apply.
All right, so your group is no?
No.
No, we
no?
said the same thing.
Okay.
We said yes.
Who? Where's the yes? Over here. And what were your reasons for saying yes?
It was a society question. We'd rather have one person live rather than both.
Yeah, mm-hmm. based on mm-hmm. utility.
Utility. You've got a tragic situation no matter what, right? Somebody's likely to die. The question is one or two. Do you increase the good by at least allowing somebody to live? Versus the deontological will argue, no, you simply, these are the rules. John stated these conditions. You follow them. It doesn't justify overriding that.
Most healthcare professionals probably are deontological in terms of it all.
But we're talking about what's moral, what's ethical. Thank you.
He said yes.
He said yes. Now, this raises the question, is this an appropriate place for surrogate decision-making?
Well, John is not a minor.
John's not a minor.
No, not on this specific issue.
Why not?
Because he has specific pre-existing instructions. If it was something about feeding or something he didn't have instructions about, then they might be able to make it a surrogate decision.
Now, let me throw this in. The organ donor card is a legal document, right? Now, how many situations are some of you even aware of where someone says, has an organ donor card, and says, I want to donate when I'm brain dead, is what that implies, and the parents say, no, do you think they do it?
Yeah.
They do not. If somebody has a card and the family says no, the surrogates say no, it is not procured, because who's going to sue, the dead person or the family? So that gets a little hazy wanting to respect what that meant, but this is the flip side. So the parents are saying,
you're looking
at
a legal argument, not a.
But you know, there's don't carry a card and be a living donor. I mean, nobody asked us that question. So one of the things you might say is that if the individual chose to be a donor when they die, there is a possibility that they might be willing to be a donor if they were alive. But nobody ever asked us that. You don't have
to. I know,
but
that's
that.
You're assumed not to
so
want
to
harm
yourself.
You can't assume
that I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Right. The assumption currently under the cards is that it is just a cadaver donation. However, you make a policy statement, which is to say, if we do advance directives of some sort, like in Minnesota, there's a section that says, what about organ donation? I could write in.
Yeah.
And if I am John in a situation like this, go ahead and take my liver if I'm going to die. But I'm not dead yet.
There are also places where this is being proposed, and that is actually presumed consent. That is, if you find, but again, it still would operate under brain death, but there would be presume that your consent is presumed unless you stated otherwise. And why are people doing that? Because we have so many potentially viable organs that are simply not being used because the person has said one thing or another. And
what,
so, go.
What Rob? About if John had signed a power of attorney, say for his parents or a partner or something like that? Wouldn't that change it?
It wouldn't if it were his parents, because his parents are legal anyway, unless he had signed a power of attorney for a partner.
Oh. Okay.
A non-blood
relative. So they're legally.
They are legally
have
next
power of attorney
for a single adult who has.
But let me ask this.
But then, no, they're next of kin, but do they have power of attorney?
Yes, they do. In this time,
anything.
Most verbal power of attorneys have specific areas where you write in all the time.
Let me ask this question, because I think Pete and others were picking up on this. The procedure that we were being talked about here is of no potential physical value to John. Right? So is it appropriate for someone else to be making a decision about a procedure that can only harm him or have no effect? Is surrogacy even relevant here? Or would we simply say no? You know, you can't make a decision about someone else's person for a procedure that at minimum is not going to have any effect, but is not going to have any benefit. Unless you're talking about there, what about beneficence in the whole sense? If this is his final wish, he wants to know that his body was used this way.
It upholds, his parents are saying that they're upholding the spirit of his wishes, even though it doesn't say so on the card.
And not all parents are all that involved in their children. I've met a lot of parents who wouldn't care and just would say, we haven't had contact with that person for years, fine.
You decide.
There's nothing in the case that says that.
In a way, that's all we have to rely on, the absence of the patient's ability to find something.
We thought about, when I first wrote the case, I thought about saying he couldn't find his next of kin at all. So that's the surrogacy question. Would we pursue trying to find them? We have 20, 30 minutes.
Say he's a homeless person, doesn't have any next of kin.
This group brought that up, which has to do with utility. Does it matter if John's 36 years old and homeless, a street person? Nobody cares about him.
Then he's required to remember that John will donate in 2 weeks if he dies. So it's
up,
will he donate or won't he? He will if he dies.
Well, it does depend on his medical condition.
And of course, the other thing is the longer you wait, the less viable the organs become. That's one of the real dilemmas, is that the organs deteriorate.
And that'll be tomorrow.
But, not in this situation. This, I mean, he's being kept, his organs are being perfused by ventilators and things. That doesn't change.
But even on machines.
On machines, they can get...
And we don't know, I mean, as we say, we don't know what the other damages from the accident are.
Yeah, and he can die in an hour, 6 hours or something.
There's a hand over here, and then we need to wrap some things up.
I'm just listening to this conversation, but I wondered, why does it stop at part of it? Why not?
Because you really
have to what else is the grab, so to speak. Why does it stop there?
I mean, so other people could get his eyes or his...
Yeah, why going in for a liver load? Why not take one?
Well, that's a good point. And this one right here, I think, is simply the urgency that's presented by another potential match right there.
Yeah, that's good.
I want to press the point because one of the things in the utilitarian perspective is say, look, this is an avoidable tragedy. We can prevent a second death from occurring, and therefore we can be maximizing good by that. But is something that's tragic necessarily unethical? I mean, what many of you are saying is that you simply cannot do it, and it's unfortunate, it's tragic that Chris is going to die, but it's not unethical. Whereas a utilitarian might argue, no, it is unethical. That's a preventable death without a comparable cost.
But we don't know that she's going to live. Right. We know that she'll die without it. We don't know that she'll live with it.
We don't know for sure that she's going to die because it's will likely.
He for John.
Yeah.
Any final comments, Dan Spencer? We need to end, probably. Somebody wanted to ask me after yesterday about Jack Borkin. You can stay after.
Oh, yeah.
But
did you
want to
mention
to
the other case?
We didn't even get to the Alaska case. Let me just say, and you can find Dr. Monsager over here. Right now, they have in their hospital a mother and daughter. The mother is likely dying. The daughter needs a kidney. And the match is there.
It's close. The mother is in a vegetative state. The child's in Seattle.
Close.
On a renal failure, needing the kidney. She's the only match. Guardian says yes, do it. Family says yes, do it. There's some question in Alaska law where the judge, you can take an organ from somebody in a vegetative state.
Yes.
Judge said last Friday, yes, take it. But members of our ethics committee are saying the judge was not aware that the woman is likely to... Her health is going to deteriorate out of the surgical procedure.
And no advance directive, obviously.
And no advance directive. Mm-hmm. Well, the family says she had signed a donor card in the past, but no way to find it.
And your gut sense is it's going to happen.
My gut sense.
Gut sense, but it's
half a chance.
Half a
chance.
So, go back to another dilemma or the other situation we were just talking about. Dr. Spencer, if you were on the committee,
You know, this is one of those ones where my gut would say, we can save a second life, do it. And reflection says we can't do it.
Yeah.
And I would feel it, and I would go home and I wouldn't sleep. But I would think, you know, it's a tragic situation, but that doesn't justify overriding. Basically, I think what we're talking about here is if you really respect autonomy, you can't presume on something's after, but it's going to, if something as invasive as taking on an organ.
So Spencer pushed me and he said, so what if I said the same thing. What if it's Chris is your sister? I said, I think I'd say the same thing. But Chris isn't my sister. I'm not living it.
Don't take my liver till I'm dead.
Yeah, write it down. Maybe we need a forum on advanced directives again before we leave the building.
No, seriously.
Anyway, thanks for coming. The tape's got to be done. Stick around if you want to.
Tomorrow we'll be looking at a related but somewhat different issue also involving organ donation and anencephalic infants. And so.